Hello, world-class listeners. Before we start today's show, we wanted to let you know that world-class host and former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, has a new book called From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia. In his book, McFaul offers a revelatory inside account of U.S.-Russia relations from 1989 to the present. The book is now available on Amazon or wherever you buy your books. Again, it's called From Cold War to Hot Peace.
You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Michael McFaul, the director of the Freeman Spogli Institute and the host of World Class. To help us understand the significance of the June 12th meeting between President Trump and North Korean Chairman Kim Jong-un, and what we can expect going forward, I'm joined today by Dr. Sig Hecker, one of the world's leading experts on all things North Korea, especially the North Korean nuclear program. Dr. Hecker is a professor emeritus in the Department of Management, Science, and Engineering, although I don't notice that you're an emeritus, just for the record's sake. You seem pretty active to me, as well as a senior fellow at FSI. He was co-director of FSI's Center on Security, on International Security and Cooperation from 2007 to 2012. He is an internationally recognized expert in nuclear security, and over the past 25 years, he's focused on fostering cooperation with Russia's nuclear laboratories to secure and safeguard the vast stockpile of Soviet fissile materials. His research projects at CSAC focus on reducing the risk of nuclear terrorism worldwide and addressing the challenges of nuclear India, North Korea, Pakistan, and the nuclear aspirations of Iran. Sig, great to have you on World Class again.
It's my pleasure, Mike. Glad to be here.
So these are big, heady times in U.S.-North Korean relations, and for everything you work on, you've had a tremendous amount of coverage in the press, including in the New York Times, for a comprehensive study that you did of North Korea's nuclear program and the timetable for denuclearization. I think you said 10 years, and the New York Times, for some reason, said 15 years. Is that right? Did they add 5 years to it somehow?
So that is correct. So Mike, Bob Carlin, Elliot Serban, and I put together this comprehensive study of the North Korean nuclear program. And that study then helped to inform, so where do we go from here?
So
we laid out this timetable, and essentially a 10-year timetable. And the idea was that, look, they're not going to give up everything right away. So it's going to be a reasonably long process.
So part of its will and part of its capacity, right, as I remember? Even if they wanted to, it would be impossible to do just by the next re-election of Donald Trump, for instance, right?
So that's correct, particularly if you look at denuclearizing, meaning getting rid of everything. So you just couldn't do it that quickly. So we laid out this timetable. What we said, halt, then roll back, and then eventually eliminate the North Korean nuclear program, specifically the military aspects of the North Korean nuclear and missile program. And we laid out a 10-year timescale. What happened in my discussions with the New York Times, particularly with one of their reporters, when he said, is it going to be possible in 10 years? And I said, it may not be. I don't know if the politics will ever get us there. It could take 15 years. Well, it turns out that's the part that was picked up by the headline writers. Ever since it's become known as the 15-year timetable, it isn't. It was laid out as a 10-year timetable.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that part of it. Well, help us understand first just the mechanics of why it would take 10 years. And then I want to dive into this idea of demilitarization that you just mentioned. But first, just help people that don't follow this in the way you do. Why so long? Why can't we just wrap it up in a year?
Actually, what I'd like to explain to people, if you look at denuclearization, first you have to understand nuclearization, what's actually involved.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So in the nuclear world, for a nuclear arsenal, you need three things. You need the nuclear materials, and most people know when you talk about plutonium, highly enriched uranium. For hydrogen bombs, you need various forms of hydrogen. So you need those materials. Those materials have associated with them a huge complex in order to be able to make them, to extract them, to fabricate
them. I see.
So you're talking, just there alone, you're talking about hundreds of buildings. And then you have to be able to weaponize. In other words, you have to design, build, and test the bomb.
Right.
That, again, takes a lot of capabilities, a lot of people, some facilities. And then the third part, you have to be able to deliver, and that means missiles. And so now you're talking about the whole missile program.
As
so
well, right.
If you're going to talk about rolling all of that back where it poses no military threat, that's an enormous undertaking. So just indeed the physical, mechanical aspects of doing that. Actually, if you could do it cooperatively, you could take it to where it doesn't present an immediate military threat in a couple of years' time frame. However, if it's not done cooperatively, the politics, in other words, what would want to make the North Koreans get rid of their nuclear weapons
right.
when it's become really the single thing which they believe ensures their sovereignty?
Right.
That's the part that's going to take time. And so what we said, you've got to weave these pieces together. And so you got to weave together the political aspects that you have to do through negotiations and then the technical military aspects.
Interesting. Well, as part of your roadmap, you have an idea that you call cooperative conversion. Explain what cooperative conversion means.
So the sense of this is that first of all, the North Koreans are not coming to the table as a defeated nation.
Mm-hmm.
They actually think they're coming to the table from a position of strength because they've developed, you know, in 2017, they tested the equivalent of intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBMs.
Right.
They tested what looks like was a hydrogen bomb. So they're sort of on top of the world.
Right.
They're not coming.
They're feeling pretty good about their recent
achievements.
They're
feeling pretty good. They're
right.
not coming in defeat. And so you're going to go ahead and you're going to have to work with them in order for them to be able and willing to give up the military part. So what conversion means is that we felt in this timetable the most important thing to do is to focus on the military aspects of the nuclear and the missile program, focus on that and drive that towards rolling it back and eliminating. However, look at the civilian programs, you know, civilian nuclear and civilian space, peaceful space programs, and those present much less of a danger and manage those with the North Koreans. And then the idea that's come to the table just in the last couple of weeks' time is to say, look, we think it's not only okay that you can manage the civilian programs, but we think it's actually to our advantage at this point in time to say, hey, we welcome you doing those civilian programs. And that's a radical proposal.
It sounds pretty radical to me.
It's a radical proposal. And so why would we welcome them doing civilian when the focus, you know, of much of the world over the years has been don't let countries like Iran or like North Korea have a civilian nuclear program because you can't trust them. That's going to propel them towards the military capabilities. And what we're saying, look, we've now established sort of a political milieu that, first of all, the North and the South is working together in an incredible fashion that I would have never imagined
right.
6 months ago.
Right.
And President Trump, you know, by shaking hands with Kim Jong-un, has opened up some possibilities. And
right.
so we say
that's also a first. Yeah.
And that's a first. So if you want to take that 10-year time range and you want to speed it up, then you actually say, hey, look, we're willing to work with you to convert all of those things that are nuclear that could be used for peaceful purposes and to do it cooperatively. So first of all, it speeds it up. And then if you do it cooperatively, what's important about the cooperative part is it gets boots on the ground. What I mean by cooperative is actually you have the South Korean nuclear technical people, South Korean space people, side by side with the North Koreans in North Korea and the Americans side by side.
Mm-hmm.
And I would maintain, based on my experience of working, you know, in many other countries in nuclear cooperation, when you're there with boots on the ground, you work with people, that's when you actually learn enough that this would be the key to verification.
Mm-hmm.
And verification is going to be the big hang-up
right.
in anything you do in an adversarial fashion. this way, do it cooperatively, I think you'd actually have a chance. And that's what makes the risk of doing conversion worthwhile.
So I want to come back to the verification in a minute, but just so our listeners are clear, cooperative conversion would still allow enrichment capabilities, correct?
So that's actually to be determined. So what
okay.
cooperative...
Yeah, explain that then.
Yeah, so yeah. I think it's very important. So what we mean by cooperative, the things that we would consider not only acceptable but welcome would be, for example, making nuclear isotopes for nuclear medicine purposes.
Right.
And for that...
For non-military
purposes. For absolutely non-military, right. This is nuclear medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have to build a reactor.
Mm-hmm.
They have a little reactor that they've used to make medical isotopes. But that reactor essentially is on its last leg. They don't have fuel anymore. So we would either say, look, upgrade that reactor jointly with the South Koreans or have the South Koreans build... I knew they built the best little research reactor that can make medical isotopes and build that in North Korea side by side. So nuclear medicine is fine. Nuclear electricity, you know, a reactor for making nuclear electricity.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, yeah, they're building one now. They've been working on since I saw it when I was there last, you know, in 2010.
Did you all hear that? We're talking to somebody who's actually seen these things that we're talking about, okay?
So I was there in 2010. It was coming out of the ground. They told me it'd be finished in 2012. I laughed. I said, there's no way. And they said, well, Dr. Hacker, you have to understand that everything in our country has to be done by April 15, 2012, because it's the 100th anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birth.
Okay.
I said, okay, I rest my case. You know, it's still not done.
Oh, okay.
So one could go in there. Again, Americans, South Koreans, work with them to say, okay, nuclear electricity, you know, may be okay. Now, would you actually then allow enrichment? Because they've
right.
built enrichment capabilities
right.
that they have now clearly used not only to try to make the fuel for that little reactor, but to build bombs. And that I would put in the to-be-determined case.
Okay.
And so there, that's negotiations. You sit down with the North Koreans, South Koreans, the Americans. You take a look and actually, I would say, look, let's take a look at the technical aspects, economic aspects, and political aspects.
Mm-hmm.
So one of those may well say, look, it doesn't make sense to do enrichment. You can buy the fuel. It doesn't
right.
make any sense.
Right.
However, I would leave it open. For space, the same thing. You take a look and say, can they have rockets that you would, you know, that they would launch into space? I would say, why not have a joint South Korea-North Korean space program?
Well, I wanted to get to that. So is it easy also to distinguish between military and civilian uses of rockets? That seems like even a harder issue in some ways.
So I think it's actually easier for rockets than it is for reactors and reprocessing and enrichment and so forth.
Because?
So those rockets that you use, you know, for the space launch, they are big liquid-fueled rockets.
Right.
And their requirements is to put something out into space.
Right.
For a missile... you have a package to deliver that has to go back in, you know, and hit
okay.
someplace. And the
technologically, that's a different project.
And so, of course, if you don't have missiles, if you don't have ICBMs, would you learn something from building space rockets? Yes. But the key here is they already have ICBMs.
Right.
See, the difference now from where we were back during the Clinton administration, during the Bush administration, Obama administration, is today their military capabilities for nuclear and for missiles is so far ahead of the civilian that the incremental risk that you
yeah.
take is manageable. That's the difference.
Okay. Interesting. So I know you're a nuclear scientist, not a social scientist or a political scientist, so maybe this is an unfair question, Sig, but why do you think an administration, the Trump administration, that so vehemently opposed the Iran deal, in part because it allowed for civilian nuclear program in Iran, would be willing to permit civilian nuclear capabilities in North Korea? Why would they sign up to cooperative conversion?
So let me give you an answer that... one of your colleagues, you know, political scientists might come with up with. And the fact is, because this is Trump's idea.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So this is Trump's deal. And so therefore, it means it would be okay. But it turns out that there are actually...
There's a lot to that.
There's a lot to that, right? Yeah. There are actually there are some really legitimate different aspects. And one is the fact as to how far Iran was with military versus North Korea. So in Iran, their military was still reasonably primitive. They were building the option for the bomb but never had the bomb. So for them to do civilian then actually is a bigger risk that they could go to military. Mm. North Korea already has been in military, and the risk is nowhere near as large. So that's right. That's a really important difference. The second one, in terms of actually especially cooperative, there is no South Korea for Iran. There's nobody else you can take in there.
Well, that's interesting.
And so that's really different. You know, what I didn't realize myself is that how big a game changer the South Korea-North Korean rapprochement was. I mean, that makes so many other things possible. The third part of difference of Iran and North Korea, the way that I see it, and I think this is actually where the agreement in some people's mind gets hung up, and that is Iran is a much bigger problem than just a nuclear problem. You know, they really are a terror in the Middle East.
Right.
We have concerns about Syria, you know, about Iraq, about Yemen, and
so hegemonic ambitions
and so it's so different than North Korea. And so some of the people who complain, you know, about the Iran deal, their real complaint is actually not on the nuclear side, but it's
all that they cover
all these other things. So that would be my answer.
Interesting. And then how do you deal with some of the constraints on providing nuclear assistance? After all, the idea of providing nuclear assistance to North Korea, that's going to sound like a rather novel idea for those that have put international sanctions in place, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. How do we overcome that?
So I was in Moscow a little more than a week ago, and we discussed North Korea. It was a session on U.S.-Russia discussing North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And I laid out my roadmap. And I would say I had a lot of international lists, both Russians and Americans, who spent their lives promoting, you know, the international regimes and so forth.
Right.
And so they took me to task on this and said, what about the international role? And so what I would say, that's really serious, because right now, all those things that I actually proposed, the cooperative, conversion, you couldn't do it by international rules because they're sanctioned.
Right.
North Korea is sanctioned. You couldn't work with any of their nuclear people. You couldn't give them civilian help if they still have nuclear weapons.
Okay.
And so what this then means, the answer is you have to work closely with the international community. Bring the international community in. My own belief is we can get that community's support because the stakes are so high.
So high. Well, the stakes are definitely high, that's for sure. Next tough question. They're all hard questions. You work on hard stuff. Lots of people are skeptical that Kim Jong-un or the North Korean government more generally will ever give up their nuclear weapons because, as you said about 10 minutes ago or so, that they see as a guarantee for their sovereignty. So help us understand why you think at the end of this long roadmap we could have that outcome.
Of course, we don't know
that
for sure. My own sense is that Kim Jong-un has a totally different view of what he wants to do in North Korea.
Okay.
And he
explain
sees,
that, yeah.
He actually sees that his people, the economy is terrible. He needs to do something. I think he may actually realize that his biggest threat is from the inside and not from the Americans. And in the end, I like to say, he's going to figure out you can't eat nuclear weapons.
Okay.
And so he's going to have to work towards getting rid of those nuclear weapons in order to be allowed to bring North Korea up to the standards that I think he actually wants
aspires to
his people. It's going to be the smartest thing to do. However, that's why we laid out a 10-year timescale.
I
don't see how you can do that with any piece of paper.
Overnight, yeah.
Overnight.
Well, here's the other scenario I think a lot about, that he signs up to this and he endorses cooperative conversion and so does President Trump. That let's just, for the purposes of argument, let's say we're moving down that path. And then the sanctions get lifted. Economic modernization starts. The Chinese are happy because they're the first investors there. Maybe it's after the Trump administration. So the Trump organization is developing those hotels on the beaches that he told us about are so fantastic. And so you already have buy-in to this roadmap. And then Kim Jong-un starts pumping the brakes. And he says, hey, wait a minute. I actually just want to hold on to a few nuclear weapons just as a guarantee. That seems to me like a pretty hard place then for the international community to say, well, then we're going to go back to this maximum pressure that President Trump told us a few months ago was the reason we got him to talk in the first place. What happens then?
Yeah, so that's a tough one. My own view is that, you know, we've tried, of course, several accords with the North Koreans in the past.
That's
the general
sure.
wisdom, conventional wisdom, is they've lied and cheated on all of them. It turns out that's really not accurate. And so if they're going to break out, you know, either keep some or go ahead and rebuild some. So one of the things that's important is how long is it going to take them breakout time? And so what you'd like to do is get as
like
far...
Like with the Iranian deal,
with
right?
the Iran deal. Mm-hmm. Get as much of a rollback and elimination as possible to lengthen that time. But what's more important yet, and I haven't heard that mentioned so much as far as the Iran deal and breakout goes, is breakout price. And that is, what is it going to cost him? What is he going to have to forfeit if he goes ahead and changes his mind? You know, if all of a sudden nuclear electricity is running through that country, but we hold the key and the lights go off.
Interesting.
Or what if the medical isotopes and all the business associated with that goes off?
This is the cooperative part of conversion,
exactly.
Right?
He's going to think twice. So in other words, we have to stick with this long enough that the price that he has to pay to step away is too high. And so hopefully he gets there. The other aspect is if it's just a matter, for example, of they come out of isolation, you know, they have relations, better relations around the world, the economy picks up because some of the sanctions are lifted. You know, I would actually take the radical approach to that and say, and wouldn't that be good?
Well, we know in other experiences in other countries that that most certainly was good. As I listen to you talk, I do remember the early Gorbachev years and a deal of that kind. Your last book about that, a two-volume study, was called Doomed to Cooperate, right? Sounds like maybe you think we are doomed to cooperate with the North Koreans as well, Sig?
So I think that's precisely it. We are doomed to cooperate. We can make it work, and there are a lot of lessons from the U.S.-Russian cooperation that would actually help us with North Korea. And essentially what it says, when you get boots on the ground, when you work scientist to scientist,
right.
when you really work professional
that personal to professional, relationships that you were such a part of for three decades.
You can make it happen.
Sounds like the first thing we need to do is translate your book into Korean as part of this roadmap.
It is being translated into Russia as we speak.
Is that right?
Into Russian,
oh,
yes.
Oh, that's great news because there was some question about that, right?
Now the first volume is done.
Well, all right. Let's get a Korean version going as well. Sig, thank you for thinking big. We need big thinkers at a time when the stakes are as high as you just said. So I really, really appreciate you coming on World Class today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Mike.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you like this episode, please review us on iTunes. It helps other people find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening in the world today and why. I'm Michael McFaul from World Class at Stanford University. See you next time.